Ace Podcast.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone Podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso. This is another week, another show, and another cryptid.
Another cryptid. But to be fair, not just another cryptid.
It's the cryptid.
He is the king of cryptozoology. He is the undisputably real, 100% factual. And nothing, literally nothing, can make me not believe that. Guys, today we're talking about Sasquatch.
Oh boy.
Oh boy.
Good old Bigfoot.
So this is our 22nd episode. We have held off talking about Sasquatch for this long for a few reasons.
Because he's a bear.
He's not a bear.
He's a black bear.
The main reason that we've held off talking about him is because we feel like it's so overdone. We wanted to give you something that is not mainstream. Now, what we're going to talk about tonight is probably a little more mainstream to actual Sasquatch aficionados, but the general public, I don't think, has a really good idea that any of this happened.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, when I first think of Bigfoot, and probably the first real story that I personally heard of was like the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Yeah.
Back in the 60s of...
Well, and with this story, because it takes place 40 years before that, we run into, again, the same sort of thing that we ran into with the Theodore Roosevelt Bigfoot story on our
Slim Documentation.
Legend show. Not only Slim Documentation, but people weren't calling it Bigfoot or Sasquatch. Because that 1950s, 1960s, that was when that terminology was really more incorporated and
became
more
popular,
normalized.
Yeah.
And now that's how we refer to... Probably even things that aren't even Bigfoot and Sasquatch, but we're not going to do any background on Bigfoot. And tell me why. You said it earlier today. You told me why we shouldn't do background on Bigfoot.
Because everyone knows Bigfoot?
Well, you said it was specifically like the fact, like how Marvel doesn't have to show us Spider-Man's origin story anymore.
Right. Everyone knows.
Everybody knows.
About Bigfoot. Everyone knows that Spider-Man got bit by a spider and got spider powers.
Now that...
And can do everything Spidey can.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, that being said, we will, I'm hoping in about 2 months, be able to offer you guys again something new, something interesting regarding more of a Sasquatch in general account, or Sasquatch in general study. So stay tuned for that. But today, we are talking about the Ape Canyon Encounter, which was the first ever nationally publicized account of a Sasquatch or Bigfoot encounter. It took place all the way back in 1924. Like I said, that's before the modern-day nomenclature of Bigfoot and Sasquatch was applied to everyone's favorite cryptid. And it took place...
He's not my favorite cryptid.
Well, the Chupacabra's your favorite
cryptid. Yeah, I know.
That's fair. That's fair. And the event took place in, as you might be able to guess, Ape Canyon, which is a canyon on the slopes. I think it's on like the northeastern slope of Mount St. Helens. And was named actually for this specific encounter. This story is why it's called Ape Canyon. Now, the focus of the story is five miners. We're going to be taking our research primarily from the account of one man named Fred Beck, who was one of the miners, as he described the story and its aftermath in a 1967 booklet that he published. Now, Beck doesn't name the other miners in this booklet out of respect for their privacy. I was able to, through a bit of research, uncover these other names, which I'm going to name here because I'm pretty sure they're all dead. The party was composed of Marion Smith. Marion Smith was the first person to report the story to the press. His son, Roy, Fred Beck, the author of that 1967 booklet, Gabe Lefevre, or Lefevre, and John Peterson. Now, in his account, Beck gives a pseudonym to one of his cohorts, calling him Hank. However, we are able to tell that Hank was Marion Smith, who back in 1924 was one of the most vocal and gave the most details of the account to the press and people around him.
Which, this is like one of the things that I don't quite understand, because we were able to find, again, articles of the original 1924 mm-hmm. account. Not easily, but we did. And yeah, Marion's name was all over it,
mm-hmm.
which I thought it was weird that for some reason Fred thought it had to be done to where he used someone else's name. That's just kind of, isn't yeah. that weird?
Well, but you've got to think, this is in 1967.
Right, 43 years later.
Yeah, 43 years later, and the big difference is if somebody wanted to go back and do the kind of research it took me 5 minutes to do, they'd have to drive to those counties and look through their newspaper archives and actually make a real
effort
to try to find it. So, I mean, it makes sense that he covered it up back then. Nowadays, it doesn't matter. We've got instant access to anything that we would need.
I just find it to be kind of weird.
Yeah,
that they're so forthcoming with their names back in 24.
Right.
And now Fred isn't.
Well, and I think the other big thing about it is back in 1924, they didn't sound like kooks. I mean, they still kind of sounded like kooks, but really what they were saying is there's some kind of weird animal out there.
Mountain devils.
Oh, we're going to get into that. But going forward, they became, you know, the first people to have this documented nationalized encounter. And granted, I'm going to say it here, was the it first really that we could find. And yeah, it was nationalized.
Because we found it on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty, well, like I said, we found that newspaper that it said was from Washington, but might be from Texas. Usually the stories get syndicated and they get moved around.
Yeah, it got picked up and published elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say it's the first. It's the first that I could find. I didn't find an earlier
account. One
of the account.
Earliest modern accounts.
Exactly. There we go. If not the earliest. Now, the group, the five miners, had been prospecting in the St. Helens and Lewis River area of southwest Washington for about 6 years by the time that 1924 rolled around. The account of July of that year opens with a description of a footprint that was seen and measured by the miners. It was 19 inches long, and the outdoorsmen had absolutely no idea what could have possibly made them. They believed that they were close to striking gold, however, and Marion told Frank that neither God or the devil could take him away from the mountain.
And can I just pause there for one moment? I did do a bit of background research.
Mm-hmm.
Surprise, surprise, I know. But I heard they actually had a surveyor out to give assessments, and, mm-hmm. and that's where they got that claim from.
Yes, yeah, that there right. was gold in them, their hills.
Right, it wasn't just, you know, these five guys going over there, that's where it's going to be.
Yeah, no.
They actually had a legitimate surveyor assess the area.
Correct, yeah, and it had been assessed, oh, he gave some crazy high number even for 1924, but essentially a lot of gold.
Yeah, they're like, going to be pretty well off.
Rich forever. So Marion had told Fred that neither God nor devil could take him away from that mountain. However, they had been hearing strange noises in the nighttime for the previous week especially. Now, these noises were described as a peculiar and inhuman whistling that would come from one ridge of the canyon and be answered by the opposing ridge. They also heard a booming, thumping sound, as if there was something that was beating on its chest. Now, because of this uneasiness, the noises, the tracks, Marion had asked Fred to go back out with him that evening to gather water. As Fred was filling the water buckets, Marion suddenly shouted and raised his rifle. Fred wheels around to see him pointing it at a large, hairy creature that appeared to be about 100 yards away. It was next to a tree, and it had dove behind it, but then it stuck its head out, and as it did, Marion fired, and they saw the bark of the tree get blown off by the bullet's impact. Marion shot 3 times, and each time it appeared that he had hit the tree. They ran.
Well, at least he's consistent.
Yeah, you know.
I wonder,
he's a marksman.
Good grouping.
He's a marksman.
That's what matters. 100 yards away is not an easy shot.
No, it's not. Now, they ran up to the tree to try to get a better look, but it appeared that the creature had vanished. However, after a few moments, They saw it running about 200 yards away, and this time it was Fred who shot at it three times before it disappeared from view. They returned to the cabin and told what had happened to the other miners, who were understandably freaked out.
I can see that being a little uneasy.
Yep. And they decided they're going to leave the next day. They don't want to go out after nightfall. They fell asleep nonetheless. Now, around midnight, everyone in the cabin was suddenly jolted awake by a ginormous thud against the wall. A large amount of chinking, which was sealant that sat between the logs of the cabin, had fallen and was pinning Marion to the ground. Fred... Oh. Yeah.
It's a lot of sealant.
Yeah, it is a lot of sealant. Well, and I'm not sure. It says the chinking. I don't know if it's like sealant mixed with an actual log or two.
In theory, if
the sealant falls out, you would think the log's fallen out too. But all I saw was sealant. So it had pinned Marion to the ground, and Fred helped him up. As he did, they started hearing sounds from outside the cabin. It sounded like there was a great number of people just trampling around, just running and pounding and making all sorts of noise. They looked outside through that hole that had been blown open, and they saw three of these creatures, but they could tell that there were more in the dark by the sounds coming from around them. Now, they start immediately and respond by shooting at them, as you would.
Yeah, figured.
As you do.
Yeah.
I would do that, and I love Sasquatch, but if he's gonna try to mess me up, I'm gonna mess him up first. However, after...
I'm assuming rifles, right?
Yes, primarily rifles.
It has to be. 100 yards away, there's no way you're that good of a shot at night.
No, no. But the creatures were not 100 yards away
I was referring to the original shot, but yeah.
Yes. Now, they start by just all-out shooting. And primarily it's Marion and Fred, because the other people are just like, what's going on? But then, after a few minutes of this, they realize... Fred realizes it's going to be a lot more effective if we only shoot at them when they're attacking us. And then maybe, even though they're animals, maybe they'll understand.
Right, get them to a close range.
Well, not necessarily get them to a close range, but get them to understand that we're not going to shoot at you unless we feel like we're in danger. This didn't work. They, by all accounts, throughout the night, the attacks continued. They kept throwing whatever they could find. Some of the rocks were as big as boulders. Other ones were small pebbles and everything in between. They did attempt to scale the roof as well. And they would hear climbing and footsteps on the roof, and the miners would then start shooting up through the roof. However, at no point did one fall, did one even indicate that it was wounded. And
how was a fire not accidentally started during this?
Yeah, I know.
Like, oh man.
Well, I'm thinking more of how did the roof not cave in?
Right.
I mean, it's got this massive creature.
Yeah, we're talking, I mean, gorillas away. Are like, what, 900 pounds?
And yeah.
They're smaller than
900 pounds.
Than what Bigfoot are allegedly believed?
Well,
like,
your typical
talking about 8 to 9 feet usually, right?
Your typical Bigfoot is between 7 and 9 feet and weighs around 800 pounds. Typically. Well, that might be a little big. 400 to 600 is more in the, like, average range.
That's so strange. Because, I mean, most apes, even, like, Gigantopithecus, which I think the Yeti was originally based off of.
Right.
Which we'll dive to, I'm certain, at a later date. But
yeah,
most larger apes are way heavier than us. Like, they're not proportionally, like, the same weight.
Right. But Sasquatch isn't an ape. He's rolling his eyes. We're going to get
okay.
There. We're going to get there. Now.
Yeah, I know. He's a black bear.
Now, at a certain point in the evening, another scary thing that happened is that an arm, long hairy arm, punches through the gap in the logs and grabs an axe, attempting to pull it out, theoretically to then cut down the door and get at them. They start firing at the hand, and it does respond by dropping the axe. At one point, Marion even attempted to bargain with them, saying that if they let the miners alone, the miners would let them alone, and they'd all go home in the morning. The creatures didn't seem too enthused by that. They laid siege to the cabin right up until sunrise, as soon as it was light enough out to see, the miners ran out, taking a look around. They see only one of the creatures remaining, watching them from a nearby ridge about 80 feet away. Now, Fred immediately just knee-jerk shoots at it three times, and it actually falls backwards off the ridge and into the canyon behind it. They immediately decide, okay, we got $200 worth of equipment. Today's money, that's $2,800 worth of equipment. It's not worth it. And they just run to their trucks with nothing but their guns, and they pile in and get out.
Planning on actually mining? What I don't understand is like $200 worth of mining equipment is not a lot. I mean, at this point in time, the modern way of mining is like using dredges.
Right. And you start
diggers.
You like start the operation on a small budget until you get the gold, your first returns, or
right.
Especially once you get the gold.
Do they just have pickaxes?
I would think so, something like that. Pickaxes, flares. Yeah, it was like manual work. Then once you actually have the gold, that's when you get investors. But you have to go in and do that backbreaking labor
right,
first.
Right, right. I know. It just seems like a small investment.
Well, I mean, if I looked at you and said, I need $2,800 for something. Yeah, I don't know.
It's a little, I don't know. I just thought that number was a bit odd for people that were like, oh, yes, we have a literally like millions of dollars beneath us.
Anyway, yeah. So they run in, they pile into the truck, and they speed off. Now, on their way home, which was Kelso, they're from a place called Kelso, Washington. On their way back to Kelso, Fred counsels them, you know, let's just be quiet. Let's just not tell anybody about this. Let's just keep it under our hats. And they're all like, great idea. And then at one point, Marion says, we need to stop here at Spirit Lake. And they don't even say why. They say, okay, Marion, let's stop here. They stop at Spirit Lake. And this is where the article that I found was from a publication called the Longview Times. Granted, I'll give it to Jason here. We weren't able to verify the Longview Times' existence through any press clippings or any repositories or anything like that.
This is the only article from Longview Times that...
that we could find.
We can ever find, yeah.
However, I don't know. I'm including it because it's 1924. Who knows if the newspaper folded, changed names, whatever. If you know, let me know. But this article from the Longview Times is one of the earliest stories to break the description of what happened to them, as well as the description of this meeting that takes place. And that meeting is between the forest guard on duty, one man named Bill Welch, and Marion Smith. Now, Welch is sitting outside. He's enjoying the natural beauty of Spirit Lake out by a barn. And suddenly a dirty, what he describes as a dirty, wild-eyed man ran up to him. This man was, of course, Marion Smith. The ranger immediately recognized him from 2 to 3 weeks earlier when he had applied to build a fire outside of a campground in the canyon. And in this earlier conversation, Marion told him that there had been devils in those mountains that were trailing him and his mining party. The ranger had never heard any reports of these things in the mountains previously, and in fact, he didn't even know of any wolves or wolverines that might be in the mountains up there. He told Marion to let him know if he ran into one of those mountain devils, and that is exactly and expressly why Marion had them stop off at Spirit Lake, was to tell him that. And this exchange that happens between them is just like my favorite thing in the world. Do you want to act this out? You said you wanted to be an actor.
All right. Well, who do you want me to be?
I want you to be Forest Guard Welch.
All right.
All right. We are now going to act out this exchange between...
You mean the four lines that we have?
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
It's good. This exchange between Forest Guard Welch and Marion Smith, because why not? This is our podcast. We can do whatever we want. We're doing an audio reenactment, people. And scene.
Isn't that what you say after you do it?
No. Yeah, I guess.
Oh.
Beginning of scene. Well, I got him. The man said as he slowed down in front of Forest Guard Welch.
Got who or what?
The Mountain Devil.
You mean a cougar?
No, the Mountain Devil.
You mean a wolverine?
No, the Mountain Devil. And that's the entire
scene.
That's it. I just love how he keeps saying, you mean a cougar? You mean a wolverine? What do you mean? The Mountain Devil. Anyway, he tells...
Uh-huh. There you did.
He tells to Forest Guard Welch, the same story that Fred Beck tells us in 1964, 1967, 43 years later, about killing one of these devils and being under siege in the cabin. The ranger says that he went to the man's car and found the four other men who looked just as crazy and just as wild-eyed as Marion, still clutching their guns and just shaking and shivering in fear. Now, Marion told him that they were leaving and were never coming back. He jumped in the car and they sped off again back towards home, back towards Kelso. The ranger was worried. He went back to the station because he was afraid that this crazy loon had, you know, went to the station looking for him, found his wife and may have hurt her or something like that. And when he gets there, thankfully his wife is fine, but she says, you know, this wild dude just came sprinting in here and ranting about the mountain devil. And Forest Guard Welch says, yeah, I know. He came and he ranted to me as well. Now, the article from the Longview Chimes, though, makes some other interesting claims. Like I previously stated, this particular forest ranger had never heard of these mountain devils previously, but during their investigative reporting, the author of the article spoke with a few other rangers in the Spirit Lake area who all of them were aware of the lore of the mountain gorillas, is what they called it. They were said to walk upright, be around 7 to 8 feet tall, and weigh about 400 pounds, and covered in black hair. Now, Spirit Lake is only 8 miles away from the site of this attack. Now, this article also claims that the Native Americans in the region had been telling stories of the mountain devils for around 60 years. However, when I checked, around 60 years ago from the time that this story was printed was around the time that the area was being settled.
Right. So, potentially longer.
Yeah, most likely very much longer. Most likely it predates white settlement. Now, the article sparked a frenzy, especially, like I said, I do believe that it went national, but especially sparked a frenzy in the people in that region, for whom Mount St. Helens was not some far-off place. It was some place they could go right now, right here. And that's what a lot of them did. It set in motion what Fred Beck refers to as the Great Hairy Ape Hunt of 1924. If I think back to a time that I would have much rather lived in than 2017 and everything that's happening in the world right now, I think I would choose, well, two options. One, Genghis Khan.
Oh, totally.
I'd want to be in his horde. I'd want to conquer the frickin' continent. So that's number one. Number two is the Great Hairy Ape Hunt of 1924. Not 74. The Great Hairy Ape Hunt of 1924.
So I would want to go back in time to, like, knight era stuff or even right. farther, more like ancient history, but living conditions were horrible.
Terrible. Really bad.
All the way up until, like, what, 100 years ago-ish? Yeah. So, ideally, like, the romantic in me were like, yeah, knights.
Valor.
Chivalry.
Bravery.
Fighting in battle. Yeah, like, that kind of a thing is where I initially go to. And they're like, no, it would really suck.
Yeah.
Especially if it was, like, my consciousness, who I am now, going back in time to live that. Oh, not having toilet paper. Yeah. I don't know how I'd be constipated.
Yeah.
All the time.
You wouldn't do it.
All the time. And sick, probably all the time.
That's fair.
If I was born in Sparta, I probably would have been thrown off the cliff.
Yeah. So quick.
Yeah. I was a little baby. I was preemie. Would have been gone.
I was just too fat. They probably would have thrown me off the cliff on account of being too fat.
You're a husky baby.
Husky babies.
You're a husky baby for all the babies.
Make short work.
Off the cliff you go. Oh, anyway, World War II.
All right. You want to be part of the greatest generation?
Pretty much.
That's fair.
Like, if I was to go back in time to a place where I would personally, like, still be able to cope.
But would you want to fight in World War II?
So,
because if not,
World War II, for me, was, like, one of the last wars that really made sense.
Oh, yeah. I agree completely.
Like, as far as I want to fight in this war.
Uh-huh. Okay.
If when I look back to, you know, the wars that we've had since then, not so much.
Right.
Like, I couldn't, like, there would have to be, for me, like, join the military now,
right.
I would want to serve, and that's why I don't join a branch of the military, right. is because I would want to do it for that purpose, and I don't feel like there really would be a war to do that unless right. it was something to that scale.
So, and it goes, it what it does is it takes your desire to be an old-timey knight and it transposes it into a livable time. Because
yeah.
it is. World War II,
it
full
was
of
still
atrocities.
Like very but, black and white, though,
and
as
it
far
was a
as...
noble war to fight. Yeah.
Right.
Probably, I mean, I don't know. We're in no way are we disparaging the military at all. We
oh,
both
no,
have
no,
great
no.
respect. Your brother is a member of the
both
military.
Both of them, yeah.
But, yeah, for us, for him, for me, it's noble. It was noble to fight the Nazis. But, all right, cool. Good sidetrack.
There you go.
I'm going to keep that in. Now, during this great hairy ape hunt of 1924, parties of hunters and outdoorsmen would flock to the area in order to try to find and capture the beasts, one of which came as far as England and requested a personal audience with Fred Beck to get his perspective on it.
Wow.
Yep.
The British. What can I say about them?
They lack fun pastimes. they have
fair.
To come here.
That's fair.
Now, many people reported seeing footprints, but the beasts themselves proved quite elusive. Now,
really?
You don't say.
Surprising.
Now, in 1967, 43 years later, Fred Beck was coming forward with this book for one primary reason. Not to tell people what had happened that day, as it was already fairly well known, but why did it happen? At this point, his account was another in a long line of sightings of what had been known as the Mount St. Helens ape, with stories from before and after his account popping up. The apes had been relatively quiet for a decade or two, but there was an uptick in sightings starting in 1962 when a group of three passengers reported seeing a 10-foot-tall hairy figure running beside their car near Mount St. Helens. A little later on, a Portland woman and her husband were fishing on the Lewis River when they saw a huge beige figure, bigger than any human, lumbering along the bank of the river before it moved off into a thicket. Now, like I just said, Beck and his crew were not the only ones to have experiences with Sasquatch in the Mount St. Helens area. Now, in fact, Mount St. Helens has been a veritable hotbed of Sasquatch sightings ever since that encounter back in 1924. Footprints and full-bodied squatches roam the area and have been seen and reported. We went back to our old friends at the Bigfoot Researchers Organization's website to find some of the more detailed sightings, and we'll link them in the show notes. Now, starting all the way back in 1924, moving all the way forward, the most recent, well, not the most recent, but some of the most compelling accounts I found were from May and June of 2002, taken in this area. Now, the first describes seeing a big black-haired creature casually walking in a east by northeast direction. The second one took place just 2 days later, around 2 miles away from the first direction, north by northeast. Now, an entire family saw it in that case. They got out of their car to check it out, but the Bigfoot caught wind of them and ran off. However, there's one other super important story in the history of Ape Canyon, and that is the disappearance of Jim Carter. Now, Carter was an expert skier. He was part of a group that was skiing Mount St. Helens one day back in May of 1950. So he decides to veer off to the left of the skiers and stop by a well-known landmark called the Dog's Head. From there, he's going to take a picture of the skiers going down the mountain. However, the rest of the group got to the bottom. They waited, they waited, they waited. He never showed up. The next day, they go back up to search for him because it was late that evening, and there's a discarded film box found right where he said he would be. Now, the photos were not salvageable, but what they also found were his ski tracks, which were more than just a little puzzling. Like I said, Jim was an experienced skier. He had been skiing for decades. And what they found by those tracks was extremely risky behavior that no experienced skier would undergo, including the fact that he jumped over three large crevices. His tracks led towards Ape Canyon and seemed astonishingly to indicate that he skied down the sheer cliff wall into the canyon, and then from there the tracks stop. There was never any body or equipment found, and Jim Carter is still missing to this day. That's probably, besides for this first account, that's probably the other most important thing that's ever happened in Ape Canyon ever. And at one point they're interviewing, there's a gentleman who was part of this group who actually had just completed climbing Mount Everest, and he was a well-known mountaineer in the Portland area. His last name was Lee. I can't remember what his first name was. But this Mr. Lee is telling the newspaper, he says, at a certain point, we finally just decided to say, well, the apes got him. There's no other explanation there as to why this seasoned skier would act so erratically. And no tracks were ever found. No bear tracks, no Bigfoot tracks, or anything other than his ski tracks going through the snow.
Yeah, it's 110% weird. I think them shrugging it off and saying it was the apes that got him right. I don't think this story at all connects with Bigfoot.
Well,
in any way,
it does based on the area. If something weird has happened in one area, people are going to say
that's the coincidence for it. Skier can easily outmaneuver a Bigfoot creature running through snow,
right?
For one, and I mean it. It's a little silly to just accredit it to the apes. I think that was kind of their brush off. I think something else might have happened to Jim.
Yeah.
Of course, unfortunately, I mean, happening to Jim, but coming from another expert skier, it's silly.
Jeff feel.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's my two cents on Jim. Sorry, Jim.
If you're listening to this, come home. We miss you.
And, dude, what is your secret?
You're 1950, like, yeah, that would have been 67 years ago. Mm-hmm.
And I'm possible. Assuming you're probably, like, in your 30s.
He was probably in his 30s or 40s. I can't find it. So he'd only be, like, 97.
Again, Jim, what is your secret?
Come home, Jim. We miss you. All right. Now, this next part here is my favorite part of this whole episode.
Okay.
And I think it's Jason's part as well.
So I like it because this is kind of the origin of what I feel like Bigfoot really is.
So you do think, let me get that straight, you are willing to concede that there may be an actual Bigfoot? Is that what you're saying?
I am willing to say that just like Chief Nampa,
right,
Native American outcast could be associated with a supernatural large being.
Right.
That likes to terrorize other things.
All right.
That is what I'm willing to say.
And you'll never get another word out of me.
Now, what we have spun that into as tales and stories change throughout time to what it is now, it's very different. But I can see where those roots of that story really originally began in these tales. And I do like them.
Yeah.
I think they're great folklore. I think they're amazing stories and myths to talk about. And you can see, again, like where our present-day pop culture stems from. And I love that aspect of it.
All right. That's fair. So you're going to put it down as a maybe.
I'm going to put it down that no, absolutely not.
I'm going to put it down as a maybe for you. All right. Here's what we're talking about now. And here's something that is so commonly, not necessarily ignored, but used by hoaxers, by sensationalists to up a story. And that is, and if you'll pardon the language, that is the old Indian legend. I cannot tell you how many times I have been reading an old-timey newspaper about this, that, or the other, and it references an old Indian legend.
Of course it does. I feel like that's the easy scapegoat in a lot of ways, too.
It seriously is. Now, what's amazing here is that I was able to find an old-timey newspaper that referenced these legends, but the difference is it was written by a member of a Native American tribe, and it was collaborated on by three other tribesmen of other tribes, and it lists their names and it lists their tribal affiliations. That is unreal to me as someone who spends all my time looking through old documents to try to find common threads and all of that. And it was like the highlight of my week, finding an actual newspaper that had an actual, real, verifiable source on Native American folklore.
Yeah, that is hard to come by.
According to these Native Americans who wrote this newspaper article.
Do we know a tribe? Three tribes.
We do know the tribes. I have them here and I'll list them. The native peoples of the area, the idea of these being apes is referred to as a white man's legend. Now, the native people of the region claim that these were not apes. These weren't animals.
They can't be apes because apes have never been in Northern America.
Now, the native people of the region allegedly claim that the apes were in fact renegade outcasts. They were their own obscure tribe of people who are known as the Sciatic. They were animalistic marauders who lived in caves and lava tunnels in the High Cascades. And we tracked down this article. Like I said, it gives the actual names and tribal affiliations of the people involved. Represented, there are three different tribes. There's the Klallam, the Lummi, and the Quinault. The article was written with the collaboration of stories between all three of these tribes' legends, and the writer of the article was a member of the Klallam tribe. Sorry for the mispronunciation, everybody. Now, the legends state that this obscure tribe was kept secret for the most part by the natives of the Pacific Northwest. The tribe was referred to as the skeleton in these people's closet, and they also knew that the white man would never believe the stories of the Sciatic.
I feel like it's like saying his name. Voldemort.
Voldemort?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like it's like that kind of a feeling amongst the tribes.
It is. I think that what it also comes down to is, and it kind of gets into it a little bit, this tribe was not dignified. It was crude. It was rude. It was socially unacceptable. It's less of Voldemort and more of like your drunk uncle that you just don't...
Like Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
You talk about it, things happen.
Yeah. And you just don't... It's
and
just...
you're not quite proud of that individual.
Exactly. Exactly. And coupled again with the fact that they knew that the white man would not believe them and just mock them. So... The Sciatic, though, were said to kill their game entirely by hypnotism, and they possessed multiple supernatural powers. They were also able to throw their voices to deceive other tribes, and they had the ability to mimic almost every bird call in the Northwest, especially the blue jay. Now,
whistling.
Right? Now, on one account from a First Nations man named Henry Napoleon... He talks about how he was hunting on Vancouver Island a number of years ago. He came across what he believed to be a large bear. However, as he raised his bow, the animal looked at him and spoke to him in the tribal language of the Klallam. He invited Henry to sit down and told Henry that he had been caught unawares. He had been projecting his mind to distant relatives of his. Otherwise, Mr. Napoleon never would have been able to see him. He went with the man to an underground cave, which took them many hours to get to, which the Sciatic claimed was the home of their people. He stated that they had in their possession a strange powder that they could apply to themselves to become invisible, and he confirmed their hypnotic powers. He stayed a day with them, and when they led him out through a subterranean opening, they walked with him until about a mile from where he was... camped. Now, the tribe is generally believed to be harmless so long as they are left alone. However, if one of the members are killed, they repay that violence 12 times. The Sciatic are mainly known as tricksters or antagonists. They would carry off supplies and sometimes carry off women who may or may not return, but they were only ever retaliated against once, and it was by a group of the Klallam tribe that captured a young Sciatic and tried to return him to their camp. However, he made a great leap and ran off towards the mountain. Now, the writer of the article, his grandfather, was the one who told him this story. He was a man named Quinchton, and he warned his people that they needed to move, but they wouldn't listen to him because they thought that his beliefs were archaic and silly, and of course there are no Sia-Tik, that's just a legend. He takes his family across the river regardless, and in the morning, when he goes to check on the remainder of the group he had been with, all the rest of his tribe has been killed. Now, the native people believed that in the time of changing from animal to human, the Sia-Tik did not absorb what is known as the Tamana Weiss, or soul power.
Dude, well done there.
Thank you. And this kind of condemned them to being both part human and part animal, while being neither at the same time. They...
somewhere in between.
Yes. I'm going to say that's probably the most likely explanation for Bigfoot I've ever heard in my life.
I think it's Boogeyman Tale.
All right, that's fair. Boogeyman Tale, Boogeyman Tale.
But, I mean, it's easy to, like, again, have a group of exiles that
right.
take refuge in the mountains.
Right.
Like, that's easily conceivable. And having them played out as being as Boogeyman, where, you know, you shouldn't do this, otherwise, you know, this is going to happen. So,
yeah.
I mean, we see it in a bunch of different stories throughout time.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I could see how this evolution of this exile tribe becoming what we think of as Bigfoot now.
Right.
And I can see that connection. I can see I do love it. I absolutely love it. But all I'm saying is that, you know, it's there's a lot of consistencies with a boogeyman tale in right. general with this description.
Right. I hear you. That's fine. But I don't think that just because a tale is a boogeyman tale necessarily means that it has to be untrue.
No, I mean, no. There's always, you know, a bit of truth
right.
to most stories, but most stories also get embellished over time.
Right. Now, I myself have dropped some knowledge previously on this podcast where in a passing remark, I mentioned that Bigfoot is not a cryptid.
Right, and your presumption is that it's a transdimensional being.
Right. The thing about Bigfoot, the thing about Sasquatch, the Yowie, the Yeti, anything, rock apes, anything that's a Bigfoot creature, is that they are not physical beings. They're metaphysical. They're spiritual. And while this seems to many people, as I'm sure you'll attest, Jason, to be completely and totally insane.
And I mean, it's a little out there.
That's what I believe. And tales of Bigfoot being associated with UFOs and being sent to humankind as a spiritual healer or a guide permeate the right circles of the New Age community, to be sure. But I think the biggest thing is that this is not a new theory. In white man's terms, it goes back at least as far to 1967 with the publishing of Fred Beck's booklet. Just like their initial encounter was the earliest Sasquatch encounter that I could find, this booklet was the earliest documentation suggesting that Sasquatch was a multidimensional, transdimensional being rather than a flesh and blood cryptid, apart from, of course, the Native American stories that have been there for hundreds and longer than that before any of this happened at all. Now, Beck offers an impressive and chilling statement when opening the third chapter of his book. He says, regarding the apes, no one will ever capture one, and no one will ever kill one. And then he drops the bombshell. This man, a simple miner.
Well, a failed miner.
A simple failed miner was a psychic.
Oh, boy. All right. I'll hear you out.
All right. Now, he claimed that on the way, as all of them were going on the way to Prospect to find their mine, there was a tall First Nations man who appeared to them and told them that they would be guided by a white arrow, which Fred and another member of the party who was not present for the 1924 attack were able to see, but the others weren't able to see it. One of those others was Marion, who, after a few weeks, months of wandering, Marion actually cursed the spirit and claimed that it had lied to them. This is obviously not something that you want to do when you're dealing with the supernatural, cursing it, yelling at it, assaulting its character. And for this reason, they were given another vision, another apparition, which it should be stated was not just Fred Beck. He claims that all of the miners saw the visions. And this happened to them. They said, you will be shown where the gold was, the gold is, but you'll never be able to get to it. And like you said earlier, Jason, they had actually had this area assessed by a surveyor who told them there was a lot of gold waiting to be found, but they never got a single scrap of it for the 6 years that they were out there prospecting. Their experiences with the apes began shortly after this curse that was placed upon them, and they would see the tracks of the beasts, but they would never actually see the physical manifestation of them. Sometimes they would hear that earlier described pounding of the chest in broad daylight, very close as if just behind them, but they never actually saw what was making it. Another time, Fred talks about a sandbank that was in the middle of a river. In the midst of the bank were two very large, deep footprints, which they had come to know as the mountain devil's tracks. There were no other prints on either bank of the river or the sandbar in the middle, and the distance that this thing would have had to walk to make it from one bank to the sandbar to the next bank without leaving prints on the other banks would be about 160 foot long steps, strides. But more likely, he claims, it was something that simply appeared into the material world and then disappeared. Now, Fred goes on to say that these beings attacked them from a lower, or they were, the beings that attacked them were from a lower plane of existence, another world nestled within our own. As many know, Sasquatch has often been posited as a kind of missing link in human evolution, the step between the ape and the man. However, Beck claims that the missing link is not one of physical evolution, but rather spiritual evolution. It is neither an animal nor a man, but a consciousness in between. Beck brings up that age-old argument in Sasquatch culture, which is, where are the bodies? If there are this many sightings, why don't we have any dead bodies, any bones? He references to an earlier part of the account when they actually shot one of the apes, and they say, you know, where did the body go? We saw it fall into the canyon. Why wasn't it recovered during this great ape hunt? And he says, you know, this is interesting because it comes down to the favorite term of skeptics is Occam's razor. What it comes down to, though, is that Occam's razor is relativistic in that it says that the simplest explanation is what's true, but the simplest explanation is a matter of your framework and your way of looking at the world. Because Fred Beck saw these things and knew that they weren't, you know, or believed that they weren't black bears, they weren't tricksters, they weren't hoaxes, in that worldview, the simplest solution to him is that these were metaphysical beings of lower dimensions popping in and out of reality. Now, he claims that back in the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve ate the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they, being humans, were incarnated into physical forms. However, the Sasquatch has been around from these times and was very much like humankind, but was not permitted to incarnate due to their lower level of consciousness. Fred believes that they are not by default malevolent. He says that the only reason they attack them is because he shot them first. They are not violent, they're not wicked, they're just curious, and it's curiosity that caused them to observe the miners for those 6 long years, and curiosity that eventually made them bold enough to be seen by them. The miners mistook this curiosity as aggression, which was returned with more aggression. Beck states that the creatures are curious because they want to achieve what he refers to as the highest form of consciousness, being human consciousness. He believes that in their search for consciousness, they will become more bold and begin to manifest themselves further and further away from the mountains and into civilization, and will become more and more well-sighted. And this is how he ends his book. He ends it with a questions and answers section, and he goes through some questions and answers. But this is the big reason why, and what he had actually been there to talk about and discuss was the actual metaphysical nature of these beings.
Oh God, where do I start? I'm gonna walk it back to their account. So there's a few things that I think are just kind of weird. And I brought this up again before the show. I think it's very odd that men that did engage in essentially like a firefight.
Right.
A Stone Age versus modern technology firefight. And were able to essentially come out with a win. They injured or killed one.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly.
Theoretically.
And then they left. Typically, a lot of miners, especially, I mean, of course, back in Gold Rush eras mm-hmm. in, you know, California, they put all of their money into setting out for these claims.
Right.
And like Marin had said previously, neither God or devil will keep me from this find.
Yeah.
It's weird that after they made this win, this victory, that they did just up and leave. Now, I understand being absolutely terrified and not understanding what's happening around right. you. But I find it to be odd that they didn't go back later.
Right.
I find it to be odd that, you know, the cabin mysteriously burnt down.
Right.
And it makes it even tougher now that, you know, St. Helens blew up in 80.
Right.
So it's a very weird set of events that have occurred around it. That and, I mean, apes and humans alike, our eyes are not set up. They're not designed for use at night.
Right.
They're very, very bad at it. I mean, that's why we don't have eyeshine. They are designed for daytime use. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense for a group of apes, possibly,
right,
in closing on an encampment at nighttime. That's very strange behavior. Now, that being said, bears mm-hmm. scavenge. So for a bear or a group of bears, a small family of bears, to follow miners as they trek to their canyon to look for gold, that makes a whole lot more sense mm-hmm. as far as what might be occurring. That, and I mean, I keep going back to bears.
Right.
For a good reason. A lot of early Bigfoot sightings fall right in the region where black bears live.
Right.
Throughout the Northwest. And I feel like that a lot of it is just our perception of what we see isn't correct. We think we see Bigfoot when really right. it's a different animal standing on two legs.
Right.
Now, when I look into the story a bit more, it's kind of funny how these apes are able to ascend the canyon.
Right.
In fairly quick time to throw boulders back down on top of them. And then they punch through the wall and reach for an axe?
Right.
How does a Bigfoot know what an axe is if they're only using large rocks as tools and weaponry? Like, how would they right. know what an axe is actually used for?
I think, well, and I think what you're, what's, from what I'm hearing, I think what you're, like, not taking into account is some of the folklore surrounding it. I mean, again, by the time this is all over, Fred Beck doesn't say that they're apes. The native people don't say that they're apes. They say that they have some sort of intelligence. As far as them moving from the top of the canyon to the bottom of the canyon, for one thing, it could just be that there's one group here, one group there. But again, if we are looking at them as a metaphysical sort of being...
I'm not. I'm looking right. at them as a physical being.
Right.
I'm looking at them as a physical creature.
Okay.
And making those assumptions.
Right. And so that might be where it's not making sense, where it's not coming up.
And it doesn't. I mean, the only reason why I could think of a group of primates to be that aggressive instead of just running away from gunfire right. is for territorial reasons. That's the right. only real thing that I can see, which doesn't make a lot of sense if they're following the miners as they get to this canyon. There's just a whole lot of pieces to this story,
all right.
to this account, that just don't make a lot of sense to me.
All right.
That is what I'm coming down to at it. Now, it makes sense to have this kind of story if you were going to mine that area. Because rival miners, you would want to scare the crud out of them, but, you know, your claim isn't compromised. That makes a lot of sense. It also makes a lot of sense to, again, get notoriety, get some sort of fame out of it. Because you did turn up dry.
Mm-hmm.
Because you did not make your fortune. It's also a really nice excuse. Say, hey, I didn't make that because of these crazy Bigfoot mountain devils that stopped us from claiming all this gold.
All right.
There's just a whole bunch of weird details, you know, that just don't rub me right.
Yeah, I hear you. It's a weird account.
But if we do look at it as transdimensional... God, that was painful. A transdimensional being.
Mm-hmm.
That does explain quite a lot. I think it's too much to assume that over other options.
Right.
Being that dimension jumping is... It has to be a difficult thing to do. It can't be easy.
Right.
So it would make a lot of more sense, though, because we don't find bodies, because we don't find bones in any kind of fossil record whatsoever. Right. And I mean, we can track everything that has lived in the Northern Hemisphere from that. And we just don't have large apes in North America. For right. some reason, it just doesn't seem like they made it across the land bridge like we did.
Right.
So if there are these crazy Bigfoot, Sasquatch roaming the land, could be that.
All right.
I like, and what I think is probably the most probable, is that they were besieged by maybe a group of bears scavenging.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly even other miners.
Right.
Of sabotage. Some sort, you know. And then lastly, and I think probably the most true, is that it became a part of the Bigfoot hype. Especially, you know, now in 67 when he formulated all his ideas. So that's a huge gap.
Right.
To publish something. Well, you think again, if he wanted to ride the story, you would come out with that within, you know, a couple years to keep it going. To
right.
keep that story alive. Keep that notoriety up.
Especially with Fred Beck, from his account, he doesn't want to ride the story. He doesn't
right.
want the notoriety. He's only but, coming out and saying it because there's been this uptick in sightings starting in 1962.
Right. Like I said, more like Bigfoot fever. And that's
right.
that's kind of what happened in that 60s era, is that we started getting a whole lot more sightings. And again, I mentioned it earlier, we had the Peterson-Gimlin film.
I'm sure it's Peterson.
That was taken in supposedly of October of 64.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really caught the attention of it. And that's when he created this.
Right, but you still have reported sightings of the creature from 2 years previous to that film.
Right,
so there
it's
was
build
something
up.
Beyond, right.
I mean, the story has to be told.
That.
People have to get the idea.
You know, you made
they
the,
had to make the costume.
Right, right. You made the point of the surgeon's photo being a sort of jumping off point for sea monsters a few episodes ago, which
right.
I think is
so
a totally
the
fair
surgeon's
valid
photo
thing.
Was taken in 1936.
Yeah.
1936. Reported Loch Ness monster sightings started in 1932.
Right. So, all right.
So like that's a kind of a natural progression that we see where we get more of the media hype from it. We get
right.
more sightings start to occur.
But you have to ask yourself, what are people seeing? What are people... Yeah, I know that you think it's a bear. Totally fine.
I truly do. I think it's a bear. I think it's other animals. Because our brains are super easy to trick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, magicians have been doing it forever. That's what... That is their gig. We're easily deceived.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure you've seen, you know, the good old checkerboard with a cylinder casting a shadow on
right.
it. And the two colors looking like they're mismatching because our brains are predicting what we're seeing.
Right.
So it's not just receiving the information, it also is making predictions.
Right.
So it's not just what we visually take in. It's also what our mind expects to be there. And again, I really do think that with a rise of Bigfoot sightings, they stem and spark more sightings because right. that's what we expect to find out there. And if I don't see something, if I see something out of the corner of my eye that I'm not sure what it is, that's where I'm going to jump to.
Yeah. I hear you.
I think it is, I don't know the motives to the story, but I don't truly think that a real event took place.
Right.
As described. And I do believe that a lot of Bigfoot stories, a lot of Sasquatch stories in general, do stem from the Native American folklore.
Right. But then you have them everywhere. I mean, Vietnam, you have the rock apes, you have the Yowie in Australia, you have the Yeti in Russia. It's possible that it's just one of those things, like we were talking about last week with hellhounds, that just pop up. Maybe we instinctively have known of our evolutionary origins from before Darwin right. and his time. But, I mean, the other thing is, especially with something that specific branching out across continents, you have to at least wonder, is there something that we're missing here?
I mean, we could say the same thing about dragons.
Well,
almost every culture across the globe has some sort of dragon-esque creature in it.
But that's the thing, is it's dragon-esque. You have, like, feathered serpents, you have from Central America. You have the traditional Chinese dragon.
Right.
But these things, especially the traditional Chinese dragon, it was not associated with those same sorts of ideas before necessarily. It had the some of the core, but if you look at European dragons, feathered serpents, and Chinese dragons, they all look extremely different and act extremely different. You have your wyvern, you have your fire drakes in your European. What? You want to fight me on dragons? I got dragonology,
no.
But
what it comes
down to there is I think that dragons fall a lot more in the concept of a Eurocentric society that comes into other cultures. The Spanish go down to Mexico. The what?
Like the Spaniards were conquering dragons at the same time that
no.
they went to Mexico.
No.
Also, a lot
what
of
I'm
Mexican
saying,
societies, culture died because of
right.
Spanish
what
conquest.
What I'm saying is that the Spaniards went down to Mexico, saw the feathered serpent, and said, oh, that's a dragon. And they were probably like, no, that's not, I don't know what a dragon is. This is not that. Same thing with the Asiatic peoples. The Europeans, Marco Polo, went to Asia, said, oh, that's a dragon. And they're like, no, this is a completely different creature. But we just cast it all under the same umbrella. But they have very different traits, different physical and appearances and traits. Whereas when you have the Yeti, the Yowie, the Rock Ape, and Sasquatch, pretty much the only thing different is their coloring. Their behavior is fairly consistent. Their descriptions are fairly consistent.
And you don't think that could not have stemmed from savage clan members?
Right.
It could just be It could
wild men living in the wilderness.
Right.
That could be the
although thing. I do believe it's probably Gigantopithecus and
right.
the Himalayas because right. that's the closest thing it could be.
That's fair.
I'll lean back on our local legends when we talked about Chief Nampa. White settlers referred to him as Bigfoot, as a Sasquatch, right. because of his size and because of savagery.
Right.
That's how they interpreted him.
Right.
That's not a huge jump to say that something similar has happened in multiple cultures.
Right, but then when you pair that with supposed physical evidence of actual foot castings, actual accounts, you have, if you're willing to look at it and believe a little, you have a much more fleshed out story than that of Chief Nampa or that of dragons. You have people still reporting these things on all these different continents in their original ways. Sure. See, maybe it's bears, but
and
still.
The problem with that now is that it's just so easy to fabricate that kind of evidence. That's the right. That's the great dilemma with the time period that we live in, is that it's easy to fabricate most things, and we have to double, triple check everything.
Right.
And with the internet, like, information is so readily available, it's easy to find, okay, how are other people already making these casts?
Right.
So if you want to make a Bigfoot cast, I'm pretty sure you can make a fairly easy one to match a lot of the descriptions that have already been made for them.
Right.
So, and then again, yes, technology is so good now, it's tough for me to believe that if there was an actual physical being out there, we would have captured on film.
Right.
At, like, real film.
Yeah. Unless
it's a transdimensional being. It's not being, a
physical creature, yeah.
Just like the Wolfman.
Yeah. Just like the Wolfman.
So I think we should probably leave it at that.
All right. We have, this last week, we got, I want to say, like, 14 new reviews.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was crazy. So right, I'm read the going worst to, one. Yeah, I'm going to.
Read the worst.
Actually, they're all pretty good. You except know, we do have one other person who said you can't speak English.
I can't. So it's hard.
That's fair. Tough. That's fair.
English is an odd language. That's why.
It is very strange. So let me pull up those. And I
can't speak Spanish either, though, so I'm kind of screwed.
If you don't hear your name in this, like, let me know if you left a review, because eventually, as they compile, they get resorted by, like, helpfulness and stuff like that. And so sometimes it's hard to keep track of everything, but I'm going to go through here. So we'd like to say a big thanks to Cat Wants More Sleep, Pelcher 314, Josh F in Texas, Mr. Scraminer, Irish Girl 3011, Baby Cakes Loves Mitchies, Tiger Lily Martinez, Durfles.
Nice.
Yep. Amazing Customer, Terrifying Tales, Ollie Dog, and the Heir of Ellendale. Thank you so much to everybody who read a review.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a lot. We are going to read the one by Cat Wants More Sleep, because it's one of my favorites of the week. So it says, seriously, just hit play. And this is what it says. All right, so maybe you're maybe into questions of the paranormal and supernatural, or maybe you aren't. Frankly, I'm not. At least I didn't think I was. But then I ran across this little gem. Two great voices in my ear laying out the history and the speculation around a topic, laying out the skeptic side and the creepy underbelly. And I find myself wondering. They're funny and they're thoughtful and careful. I like their honesty and their courage, because sometimes it takes a lot to be able to look into the dark side of things and then want to talk about it. Not to write some dry article that no one will read, but to actually give us all the details. Sam and Jason, thanks for an amazing podcast. You obviously work hard on it. You make an amazing team. Keep up the amazing work. I look forward to hearing more. So thank you so much.
Wow, that is awesome. I think that is the great thing that we have here, is that at least we spur ideas for conversation.
Yes.
Like, if you take anything away from this, like, get the gears turning. Right. You know? At least you can bring this to, I don't know, family dinner and have another conversation as well.
Right. I agree completely. Now, we're not going to read the other review, but I would like to give a special shout out here. One of the people who left the review, and I'm going to share this information because it is, you can see it by going on iTunes. It's there for anyone to see. So I double checked with a few people. They said they think it'd be okay. So I'm going to do it here. I'd like to give a shout out to Irish Girl 3011. In her review, she mentions how she is binge listening to the podcast as she starts her first chemo treatments for breast cancer. Irish Girl 3011, it is our honor to keep you company during that. We hope, even if you're getting just comfort, if you're getting a few laughs here and there, it is our great joy to be able to accompany you on that. And if you would like, I would love for you to reach out to our email address, notalonepodcast@gmail.com. Send us a message. And we would love to get you, you know, a free t-shirt, get you some stickers or something, to anything we can do to help. And thank you so much for being a listener. Stay strong, and we're going to be here for you every step of the way. So next up, we also got a lot of patrons this week, which is pretty cool as well. Let me do this here. I'm going to bring up all of them. We got from the last time we did our patrons, I think we got about seven more.
Oh, goodness.
So, or six more. We'll see. So, first off, we have The Ends, which is actually Kevin Allen. So we're going to say, yay, Kevin.
Yay, Kevin!
Kevin writes and produces The Ends, which is one of my favorite history podcasts. I've mentioned it before. Next up, we have Jenny Becker.
Yay, Jenny!
Next up, we have Janilyn Prude Bergenon.
Yay, Janilyn!
Next up, we have Eric Ramsey.
Yay, Eric!
Next up, we have Jeremy Stringer.
Yay, Jeremy!
And last up, we have Van Jones.
Yay, Van Jones!
Thank you all so much for your support through all of this. We do have one other podcast we'd like to recommend for you really quick. It's called Strange Matters. It's a member of the Dark Myths Collective along with us. They have a very similar sort of format, but they dive, I would say, into even deeper phenomena and accounts. As most of our listeners know, we prefer more of a narrativistic style where we tell a specific story instead of just giving an overview of a phenomena, because I think that's what suits us. But with Strange Matters, a lot of times they'll take, like, I was listening to one on, what, how is it pronounced? Psilocephony. And that, it means the phenomena of humans having dog heads and wolfmen, dogmen, all of that.
Perfect.
And just really lays out the phenomena like that. They do a little bit of, like, not a whole lot, but a little bit of mysterious disappearances, potentially true crimes kind of stuff. But the majority of it is weird, paranormal, supernatural. He actually says, like, their intro is something like, you know, welcome to Strange Matters, your source for the paranormal, mysterious, and unexplained. And our original tagline is all things mysterious and unexplained. So I feel a kinship with them. I feel really good about them. We'll put a link to them in the show notes. It's just Strange Matters Podcast. They're pretty great. And I am 100% sure I'm forgetting something, but whatever. We'll do it next week if we did. So
that was good to me, Sam.
I did it last week, I think.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, because you did local, I did hounds.
Oh, yep. All right,
I did it last week.
Remember, whether you're trekking through a canyon in the dark or shooting down apes, we are not alone.